Once again, we are a little bit short of our quorum, but we're going to begin because we have people that are tuned in from all over the world to listen to the proceedings of this committee. My mom, no, actually she's. We want to make sure that we respect everyone's time, especially yours. And so let's begin. I need to let you know at the outset that I need to testify in another committee in 4 minutes. And so I'll be here for three of those, and somebody will walk in, but we'll continue. Whatever I miss, I'll pick up by getting a copy of the proceedings on the DVD.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We will continue. Yesterday we concluded the public health portion of this presentation and got most of the way through discussions about our mental health and addictions services, and Bob Nickel is here to complete that discussion this morning. At the end of his remarks and following any questions, we'll begin talking about the Office of Medical Assistance Programs, and Barney Spate and Lynn Reed are here to do that.
Great. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. For the record, again, my name is Bob Nickel. I'm the administrator for the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services in the Department of Human Services. Continuing with my presentation, I was going to move into community mental health services next for children and adults. There is one key performance measure, that's number 28, in your folder. It is in Phase 1 Performance Measures, page 2. The key performance measure is the percentage of mental health clients, and it doesn't say this, but these are adults, who maintain or improve their level of functioning following treatment. And the benchmark that we reached was 92% of clients either maintained or improved their level of function. This is based on enrollment and termination data based on the global assessment of functioning, which is a standardized, nationally recognized measuring tool. So we exceeded the target established in 2002. I may have touched on this yesterday, but we did have a chart showing the changing access to mental health services. And just as a reminder, anytime you're dealing with a highly stigmatized disease, just getting people in the front door and keeping them there is a good thing, because that's how you are able to deliver treatment over a period of time. So as you can see, we increased from 1994 from a little over 40,000 adult clients. We peaked a little over 70,000 in 2001 when we began to decline. Most of that is, in my opinion, due to the loss of the Oregon Health Plan standard benefit package, either temporarily for that period of time when we didn't have a mental health package benefit, or during the time when we'd been phasing down from 100,000 eligibles. For children, I think I mentioned before, you don't see the dramatic increase that happened in the mid to late 1980s, but you can see it's been a fairly steady path on children's mental health services, serving about 30,000 children in 2003. You may want to look ahead in your booklet to Phase 2. I don't have the tab in front of me, but there's a chart on page 13, and it's a chart that shows the decline in crisis mental health services between, it's a 10-year trend period, but there was a dramatic decrease for adults receiving crisis mental health services in 2002 and 2003, and again, this is directly related to funding decreases. We lost all of our state general fund for crisis services for a period of about a year there, and it shows in the number of adults who dropped in terms of their access to crisis services. And again, these are 24-hour, 7-day-a-week crisis services operated by all of the community mental health programs. I wanted to mention a little bit about children and adolescent community services. We do family satisfaction surveys, although it's not a key performance measure. We showed that 2/3 of the families felt positively about the services they received. In my opinion, this indicates that we have room for improvement, and the Children's System Change Initiative, in fact, is targeted to do just that. 81% of the families surveyed after services indicated that they had a high degree of cultural sensitivity in their experience with mental health staff. We'd also like to point out that we invest a certain percentage of money in psychiatric day treatment and residential programs. And between 2000 2001 and 2003, those programs, psychiatric day treatment for kids and psych res care, treated between 800 and 900 children each year, and when they discharged them, they were able to go back to their normal school or family environment. Sometimes those are foster families, but I think we sometimes overlook the fact that when we treat and then discharge kids back to their normal environments, that indeed is a performance measure, in my opinion. We did see a drop in the number of children who could attend psychiatric day treatment because we lost all of the unmatched state general fund support for these programs in 2002. In the area of adult community mental health services, I think one of the things that we tend to overlook, too, is that one of the core functions of a community mental health system is the civil commitment process. And for the last several years, about 9,000 people each year come to the attention of family members or law enforcement or hospitals or neighbors, and they are believed to be dangerous to themselves, others are unable to care for their basic needs. So we start off with a pool of about 9,000 people every year who enter the gates of the civil commitment process. We divert about 8,000 of those people to other community services. Sometimes this is getting them re-enrolled in services that they'd kind of dropped from. Sometimes it's getting people we haven't heard from before, new people to the system, and getting them enrolled sometimes for the first time to community services. We often find that crisis respite programs, other kinds of enhanced crisis services, medications, all of those kind of interventions are critical in this process of diverting 9,000 people. That's 22 people every day of the year, Saturdays and Sundays included, that come to the attention of someone who believes that they have a serious mental disorder that's making them dangerous to themselves, others are unable to care. Again, I think it's easy to overlook the numbers of people that the community programs process every day. And so I think that indeed that is a performance measure. For those people that we cannot find other community services for, we do commit about 1,000 people a year. The actual rate of civil commitment is going down. In other words, with population increases, we haven't seen an increase in the actual number of people who are civilly committed. And again, I think that represents a hallmark of a mental health system that doesn't increase its civilly committed people each year as population goes up.
Senator Winters.
No, I didn't have questions. I was just looking your way.
Continue.
Another performance measure that I'd like to mention is that 81% of the adults served in Oregon's community mental health programs reported that they felt positively about the services they received. And again, we can note the key performance measure is 92% of enrolled adults maintained or improved their level of functioning. And this is for the final 6 months of calendar year 2003. It's the most recent data that we have, and it was a sampled survey.
Excuse me, Bob.
Yes.
Bob, just to clarify, this is key performance measure number 28, right? And it talks about 92% of clients either maintaining. When you survey, how is the survey conducted, and who fills out the survey? Is it?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Britton, the survey is based on the client process monitoring system, which is admittedly a rather outdated mainframe system. This is not the personal computers. This is the mainframe that we're working off. But it's effective in allowing the worker, the client's counselor at the end of treatment to assess whether based on the global assessment functioning scale, whether the client improved or at least maintained their functioning level. So it's based on our basic enrollment and termination data. Another way to think about what community programs do in terms of performance measures is the following. In 2004, we served about 24,000 adults who carried a diagnosis with them of schizophrenia or other major psychotic disorder. Now, it's well known in the literature that if you do nothing with people who have that serious a problem, about half of them, one-third to one-half, will relapse. Relapse for people who are psychotic, where people have schizophrenia usually means something like hospitalization or incarceration or some other outcome that we really don't want out in the community. So one way of thinking about the fact that we serve 24,000 adults with that kind of a diagnosis was that we probably avoided up to 12,000 additional really bad outcomes for those people. In other words, if we didn't serve them, the pressure that we have on our emergency rooms, the pressure that we have on hospitals, the pressures that are already tremendous in the criminal justice system, in my opinion, would be considerably greater. Looking at another major diagnosis that we serve, which is bipolar, it used to be known as manic depressive illness, or other major mood disorder, we served about 20,000 adults with those diagnoses in 2004. And again, research suggests that the percentage of those people who would relapse would be more in the range of 10 to 30%. So it isn't quite as quick a downhill trail if you don't serve people with bipolar or major depression. But again, we could estimate that there could be as many as another 2 to 6,000 hospitalizations, incarcerations, or really untoward consequences if we didn't serve those people. So I think those are things well worth keeping in mind is in terms of basic performance measures for the community mental health system. Finally, you know, there are many other performance measures that we look at in quality improvement programs throughout the state, but I just want to mention one thing related to housing as an example of the kind of things that can happen. We have some federal funds, and within that federal grant, it's one of the Real Choices System Change grants, and we have a limited amount of money that we used over the last couple of years. It's $136,000, give or take a few dollars here and there, which has allowed 373 adults to move from either homelessness, hospitals, or group living environments like nursing homes, group homes, room and board facilities and jails into less restrictive care, and the primary less restrictive care settings that they move to are their own apartments or houses, either alone or with relatives. And so for an average cost per person of $366, which largely goes toward helping them get furniture or a month's deposit so that they can actually move from a setting where they're no longer needing to have that level of care into a more normal environment, for a pretty modest investment, we're seeing, I think, some really positive outcomes. I'm going to move into just briefly talk about gambling addiction treatment, so I don't know if there are other questions about community mental health performance.
Any further questions? Okay. Proceed.
All right. The last area that I wanted to talk about was gambling addiction treatment. Again, there's no key performance measure for this, but I just want to point out that on page 3, and I believe this is in the performance measures section, we showed an
performance measure section.
we're behind it's the tab behind the OMHAS, the Office of Medical or Mental Health and Addiction Services. Performance measures and outcome, page 3.
Thank you. This is under other outcome measures.
Under mental health. Let's see.
This is immediately following the key performance measures section on pages 1 and 2 of that tab. As you
we're
can
all getting there.
Okay.
I have nothing
you.
In my section, so we'll get something.
Probably stuff that came in that you put in wrong.
I think you can proceed. We're getting close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gambling treatment is funded with lottery funds, and in 2003, 1,399 problem gamblers were enrolled in the program. As you can see, males comprise 54% of that and 24% of the family. Clients. The racial and ethnic distribution mirrors Oregon population. And I think the important point to note here is that we've seen an increase of 800 individuals being served. One of the key risks in people with problem gambling issues is the risk of suicide and depression, and then obviously the financial issues that come along with a severe gambling addiction problem. So I think the fact that we were able to get 800 additional clients into services in fiscal year 2003 gives us a chance to serve them. Particular outcomes for gambling treatment shows that 79% of the problem gamblers who enroll in Oregon's publicly funded treatment program report either no gambling or much less gambling at 6 months following case closure. So we do have the capacity to do some follow-up with people after they leave gambling the treatment, and we're showing, I think, some pretty impressive results there. And 76% report improved quality of life. Again, there are many other performance measures that we could talk about through the entire addictions and mental health system, but this is an attempt to give, in a limited amount of time, some brief overview of our performance objectives.
The question might be then, would that be a performance measure? I mean, would that be the performance measure you would choose if there was one for this section?
Mr. Chair, yes, I think those are good points of data to look at. Not just the access issue, which, as I pointed out, I think is important when you're dealing with stigmatized illnesses, but also to point out whether people actually report gambling less and whether we can see other changes like improved quality of life. So, yes, indeed, I think those are good measures.
And just a follow-up question, why so many people don't finish the program? What's the barrier to them finishing?
Mr. Chair, that's an interesting question. It's when people come into the program, they set up a treatment plan, and then the intent is, I'm sure on all parties' sides, to work that treatment plan through to completion. However, it's not unusual at all in social services fields and mental health or addictions treatment for people to leave treatment sometime before they actually complete every item on their treatment plan. But I think the fact that there are still good outcomes, even for those people who don't complete treatment, indicates that while it may not be the most optimum process that they went through, they still get a lot of good out of the process, even if they ended up early.
I don't know how we do this, but if you don't complete your treatment for Dewey, you don't drive. If you don't complete your gambling treatment, I don't know how you keep them from gambling. But take away their card, huh?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Bob, I've always been interested in, and this is something you probably can't answer, but prior to Oregon going into the lottery business, we had a significant gambling problem in the state. I had patients and actually one employee who was chronically addicted to gambling, either online or by the phone, down into Las Vegas and Reno. There was no treatment for those people. Ruined lives, ruined jobs, and people got fired and went to jail for embezzlement. It was a terrible situation. And I've always wondered in my own mind if going public with what I consider a vice is something that is making it open and worsening the condition, or making it open is just recognizing that's part of our society. It's something that can become a vice for some people, and others it's just simple entertainment. But now we at least have dedicated funds from that. Help take care of it. I'm going to tell you that the bookies in Reno and Las Vegas never sent money up to Oregon to help with addiction. Okay, they may send somebody up, but it wasn't for that kind of remuneration. You know, Gino and the boys showed up and broke legs. So, my point being that have we actually improved the situation or opened up a Pandora's box and made things worse? What's your sense on that? If you have any sense at all?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, I rely on our expert, Dr. Jeff Murata, who is the director for our gambling addiction treatment program. He's a PhD psychologist who's actually beginning to get national recognition as well as international recognition for the work that he's done. And he talks about that. I think he would answer the question this way. It's really a question of exposure. The more people are exposed to opportunities to gamble, the more likely that more people are going to have difficulties. However, he would also point out it's a very small number of people who actually get into difficulty with gambling. So although more people gamble, it doesn't, another way of saying is more people gamble successfully in the sense of not developing a gambling addiction problem. But the more people who are exposed, the more problem gamblers there likely will be.
Thank you.
Same with alcohol.
Please continue. Are you?
Well, I think that would bring my presentation to a close.
All right. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
before we move on to the Office of Medical Assistance Programs, in anticipation of tomorrow's discussion of priorities, I want to emphasize something that Bob said yesterday, and that is that most of the people that we work with come to us for treatment voluntarily. And there is a mandate level of service, civil commitment, commitment, operating a state hospital, those kinds of things. But one of the interesting aspects of the mental health business is that if we only did what was mandated, if we waited until people were as sick as they needed to be in order to be civilly committed, for example, we'd have a very much larger state hospital. And in days before there were all of these effective medicines and treatments available, we had thousands and thousands of people in the state hospitals because their illness was so severe they couldn't live in the community. So there is a relationship between mandated service and voluntary service, and I hope we can have some discussion of that tomorrow.
Great.
Very, very interesting, the public health aspects of the mental health system. It's not just a treatment system, it's a preventive system as well. With that, we'll move on to the Office of Medical Assistance Programs. Barney Spade is here, as is Lynn Reed. And I'm going to take my place in the front row.
Good morning, and thank you for being with us. As you get started, line us out where you're going to work from in the workbook, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members of the committee. For the record, Barney Spate, administrator of the Office of Medical Assistance Programs, Department of Human Services. Joining me this morning is the office's senior deputy administrator, Lynn Reed. And later in the presentation, we'll have Judy Moore Peterson, who is the manager of our analysis and evaluation section, go through the performance measures. First, let me give you let me tell you the references that we'll be using. In your book, our primary overview material is behind the tab labeled OMAP Overview. You'll also notice that within that overview, there are references, and as we move through this, we will duly note them, that there is an appendices with several appendix labeled A through F that offer some additional information that we'll refer to. And then when Judy Moore Peterson joins us, we'll be working behind the tab performance measures and outcomes. In addition, we'll have a few PowerPoint slides, as you've had in other presentations, that will hopefully add clarity to some of the remarks that we're making. And I believe this morning you received some hard copy handouts that will be primarily referred to by Judy in the performance measures, but there is one handout that I will, in the conclusion of my remarks, I'll refer to on the last page. So those are the materials that we'll kind of work through, and we'll try to keep you guided as we move through where we are in the presentation. Our intent this morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, is to give you an overview. I will start out with a little bit of what's called the big picture and a little of the history and some of the accomplishments in a very general policy sense of the Oregon Health Plan in the last 11 years. Lynn will then spend some time talking about populations or eligibility, what we refer to kind of in the triad of medical assistance program, who's covered. She'll then describe the benefit packages that we administer on behalf of our clients, that is, what's covered. I will come in then and discuss how our services are delivered and managed, that is, the delivery systems that we use, the approaches that we use strategically to manage the Medicaid waiver demonstration, and then a little bit about our organizational structure, and then we'll conclude hopefully today with an overview of our performance measures. So that's the intent of the outline. Let me start, as I know you've seen in other offices and clusters, with this pie chart. It's merely to set a context. We'll get into much deeper detail, I know, in phase two and beyond. But this gives you a sense of the context of the Office of Medical Assistance Program. The pie chart in the upper right quadrant indicates the 05-07 governor's recommended budget for the Oregon Health Plan, including both physical medicine, dental health, and mental health. And as you can see, it's a substantial portion of our total budget. In fact, it's about 90% of the resources that are invested in health care in the state are in the Oregon Health Plan. Moving to the top box on the left, Lynn Reed will... Yes, excuse me.
Because this is difficult for us to see, is this provided in any of the information that we have?
This one. It's called health
in the handout?
Services, so
I believe that there was a packet of health services cluster handouts, and this is in the packet. I can give you a little overview that the Oregon Health Plan total funds budget is about $3.39 billion. A substantial portion of that, almost $2.1 billion, in federal funds. There are really four components that are depicted here that we'll get into some descriptive detail subsequently. And again, I'm just trying to set the page. Picture is there's the Oregon Health Plan generally. The box to the upper left, in the upper left quadrant, is what we call the non-OHP. And Lynn will describe that component of the program. It's much smaller, about $252 million total funds. The box to the lower left quadrant.
We need light up here.
Because we can't read that, so we're reading this.
And some of us will fall asleep, so you just can't do it.
The third programmatic piece of the Office of Medical Assistance Program is the CHIP program, the acronym Child Health Insurance Program. Also known in some health policy sectors as SCHIP, because as it was passed by Congress, it was referred to as the State Child Health Insurance Program. That's about $74 million. And then the last quadrant in the lower right are the administrative and program support funds that fund the operation of the Office of Medical Assistance Program. In a broad overview, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as I said earlier, about 90% of the funding of total funds goes to the Oregon Health Plan, almost about 7% for non-OHP, and we'll define that in greater detail in a moment or two, about 2% to CHIP, and then about 1.7% to administrative and program support. I'm now on page one under OMAP overview, and the mission of the Office of Medical Assistance Program is to plan and implement medical programs that assure access to basic health care services for eligible clients. As you can see there, we have four broad-reaching goals. One, to increase the access of health care for low-income Oregonians. Two, improve the quality of health care and the receipt of preventive services by low-income Oregonians, and thereby hopefully improving their health status. And lastly, to manage the programs strategically so that we can contain the growth of healthcare costs and operate within funds that are approved. As many of you know, the Oregon Health Plan, as it's known within the state, has a history dating back into the 80s. On page two are some of the principles that were used to help design the Oregon Health Plan Medicaid waiver program. I just touch upon several of them that I think remain very important today, and that is the principle of having access to a basic level of care, that we try to use a process of defining what that basic level of care is in a publicly debated consensus-building approach, and I'll get into the prioritized list of health services because I think that's the process that actually demonstrates the implementation of that principle. The next one that I think is important and is probably one of the strongest legacies of the Oregon Health Plan is, in fact, that the healthcare delivery system must encourage the use of services that are effective, appropriate, and to discourage overtreatment. In many ways, the founding principle of the Oregon Health Plan which is now termed evidence-based medicine, was actually a process that was coined 11 years ago, and I think we embrace that principle, and through the Health Policy Commission and through the delivery system management that I'll discuss later, almost every day of our life. Further down that page of talks about sustainability and explicitness, that is to clearly fund what we're going to pay for and clearly make some decisions about things that are not effective that we won't fund. And you can see at the bottom that the plan won't cover ineffective care. And I'll mention that in a moment when I get into the prioritized list. The any Medicaid program, but I believe Oregon's Medicaid program remains dedicated to reducing cost shifting. That is to provide health care services to vulnerable, low-income Oregonians and thereby avert the need for them to use the emergency rooms, unfunded care, or actually be admitted for care that could have been prevented through early intervention. And lastly, the second pillar, I believe, the first, if I could describe my history of watching the Oregon Health Plan and being involved in one way or the other over the last decade, I mentioned evidence-based care, which is really the prioritized list. The other pillar, from a principal and management point of view, is the emphasis on managed care. And I'll get into in a few minutes in discussing the delivery systems about how that principle has been activated over the last decade.
Barney, a question.
Senator Winters.
I know there was a movement nationally to go managed care. Are all the other states still in a managed care mode, or are some of them going back to fee-for-service?
Mr. Chair,
what's the national trend?
Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, let me respond to that in two ways. Looking at it historically, the adoption of managed care as a fundamental principle for the Oregon Health Plan in the late 80s, early 90s was really part of what I think was a national strategy in both the commercial or insured market and the Medicaid market to move to managed care. As I think probably you all know, there's been a substantial retreat in managed care in the commercial sector across the nation. There still remains various forms of it, but it's clearly not the strategic thrust that it was in the 90s. In that same time period, many states adopted managed care approaches like we did. We can get you comparison information, and Lynn may have a more informed perspective, but I think generally speaking, most state Medicaid programs have been under a lot of pressure of keeping Medicaid managed care in place because of the pressure of rising costs and also managing benefit package, et cetera. A classic example that many of you have probably read about most recently is what TennCare, Tennessee, had a very advanced and progressive managed care approach. They're going through major restructuring now, in part because they didn't address a few years ago the issues of cost and benefits and eligible population as did this state. There are many other states. I point to Minnesota and the state of Washington, all of whom have continued to use managed care, continue to try to work to keep it as a stable strategic piece of managing long-term costs. So there's been some retreat. There's additional pressures, but I think I would. Be so bold as to say, I think we've done among the best jobs of sustaining managed care in a difficult environment.
Well, it would be well to have those comparisons, particularly since the commercial market is going
yes.
the other way, and what does that mean? And also, there's a recent report that was done in, I believe it's Budget and Taxes, that you may want to look at, that actually did a comparison between the pro-Medicaid and pro-pay systems. And it was interesting because the five states that they chose, Oregon was one of the five that was doing well. So if you haven't seen the report, you may want to get a copy of it and look at both from the standpoint of recovery of assets.
We'll do that. And Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, we've got some information that I think we can do, particularly looking at those states that have used managed care for some period of time, of comparing their enrollment and their history to ours.
Thank you.
I mention also that you brought up Tennessee, and Tennessee, I think, just recently lost 325,000 clients from their managed care system, but I believe that we would see that they lost the ability to control inpatient and time and stay in hospitals and to control pharmaceutical use, and that as a result of losing those two components of managed care, it put them upside down. Senator Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Marty, this is really going to be a key discussion as far as the Oregon Health Plan is concerned, and we may want to take a few minutes to flesh out some more information here, and I think it might be worthwhile to do while we're on the topic. I know we're only in phase one here, but for many of us who've worked with the Oregon Health Plan for years, we feel the backbone of the plan is really the managed care plans that are basically county-based in most cases, not all. And if you look at the rising cost of health care and the dropping cost of health care in the 90s, you can see as managed care was taken out of the private market, costs ratcheted up in the opposite direction. Managed care was lost for a lot of reasons, and we can discuss those. There's a lot of decisions made that were based on patients being unhappy with managed care, feeling they weren't getting the services they wanted. But basically, managed care was working to bring health care costs down in the United States, and in fact, the loss of that managed care in the commercial market is one of the major drivers for it going the other direction now. Not the only one, but a major driver. Having said that, managed care in the Oregon Health Plan has continued to be successful. And I think we can show and will show that it is. And that discussion is one we need to have here, Barney. And also understand that managed care in Oregon might be quite different than what you've seen in other places. The commercial managed care proponents who were here early with Oregon Health Plan left the state, and it was taken over by local groups. The dentist stepped up and did a wonderful job in managed care and continued to do so. Local county groups sprung up and became physician and hospital-based to bring us good managed care. They've got good access, good cost ratios, and have been successful. And we need to bring that story to this committee and to the public. And Barney, I'm expecting you to do that.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, when I get to page 12, I'll be prepared to respond with some detail, and I'm sure that there'll be more detail requested, because I embrace the comments that you made, and I'm prepared to speak to some of those issues that you've raised.
Mr. Chair, thank you for indulging me.
I just have another request that you can bring forward later, and that is, I know that there was a study that was done that talked about health care cost was across the country was exceeding the cost or investment in K-12. Oregon was not one, by the way, that was true. So you may want to bring that forward so members can see it, because it is happening in other parts. I think it was 23 other states where because they had not managed their Medicaid or their health care budget, that they're seeing their cost in excess of what they would be paying in K-12. So those are just some things that I think that would be helpful for this body.
No, Idaho has said that their two number one problems financially are the health costs and corrections costs, and that they far exceed what they're spending in education.
Yes, we'll get those, Mr. Chair, Senator Winters, because particularly in the last 12 to 18 months, several states are saying that the cost of their Medicaid programs are the single largest driver of their budget, or number two. And I think we're not in that first rank. It's still a major cost of state government, but it's not eclipsing it our budget like it is in other places. I'm on page 3, just a little bit about the reform and expansion. As many of you know, we operate under a Medicaid demonstration waiver or waivers. We received our first waiver in the early 90s. In fact, the Oregon Health Plan, the Medicaid waiver demonstration program, was launched on February 1, 1994. So we're about 11 years into this. And our most recent waiver was approved in July 2004, and I believe runs through end of October 2007. Is that correct? And notice that one of the tools that the waiver process gave us was in fact a waiver from the standard Medicaid benefit program, and the middle paragraph on that page refers to an important partner in the management of the Oregon Health Plan, which is the Health Services Commission. And I know that many of you have at least heard about the list of prioritized health services, in which we actually look at all of the possible physical health, dental, and mental health conditions and treatments, and they're actually prioritized, have been prioritized by the Health Services Commission in a very public way relative to effectiveness, looks at both medical efficacy and also the social values of Oregonians. And our current benefit program is approved by the federal government and is funded to the first 546 lines of some 730 medical condition and treatments. And I'd refer you to Appendix A. You can get a sense of the prioritized list. We've just given you two pages to show you the condition treatment pairs that are fundamentally just below the current approved list, using both the scientific or medical vernacular plus layman's language.
Where is that?
It's the first appendix, Appendix A1, behind the tab that says appendices, and it's labeled OMAP Appendix A OHP Prioritized List of Services. And it's just an example, and we can provide you with the complete list. It fills a three-ring binder. But the point being is that the core of our benefit structure, and Lynn will get into this, is the prioritized list of treatment condition pairs. And many of you know that Senator Bates, before he received a certificate of general election, served for many distinguished years on the Health Services Commission, working in that. That's a key part of our strategic management. I don't want to spend too much time, but we've laid out some of the successes of the Oregon Health Plan over the last year, last 11 years. There's clearly access to coverage that people who would not have otherwise been covered in the Medicaid program, and also the use of managed care. I do want to, in an overview sense, we created this picture both within this chart within our offices, but with assistance from the Office of Health Policy and Research, Dr. Goldberg Shop, because I think it's important in a contextual sense to see the Medicaid program laid against uninsurance levels generally. Because state Medicaid programs in general and the Oregon Health Plan Medicaid demonstration waiver plays a very real role of helping people who are low income and potentially with high medical costs, of helping insure them and helping keep the uninsurance levels down. Now, this is a historical picture. The bar graph indicates the percent of total population that Oregon Health Plan enrollees represent. So you can see that in 2004, the Oregon Health Plan enrollees on average for that year represented about 12.3% of the total population. The line graph that's above it tracks the levels of uninsurance in this state over the last 14 years. And you can see that the era out of which the Oregon Health Plan and other health reform initiatives of the late 80s and early 90s is that we were looking at uninsurance rates of the 16 and up to 18%. Referencing back to Senator Bates's comment, we saw a great decline from 1994, which was the rise in the blue bar graph up to 11.4% was when the Oregon Health Plan expansions were initiated. But that whole trough in there of the uninsurance is a combination of two things. One, a very expanding economy, and employer-based coverage grew, and also the presence of the Oregon Health Plan. What's happened with the uninsurance rates in the most recent years, and Dr. Goldberg is more expert at this now than I am, but I've dabbled in it in previous lives, is in fact the changing nature of employment-based coverage, the cost drivers that are influencing that. And you can see that the Oregon Health Plan as a percentage of the population over the last 4 to 5 to 6 years has remained pretty constant at about 12 in the 11, high 11s or 12% of the population. It's my point here is just to understand that the Medicaid program and the kind of counter-cyclical nature of employment-based coverage and the needs of the population play an interesting hydraulic role. I'm now going to turn to page 4. Indicated that we have the Oregon Health Plan Medicaid program, the Oregon Health Plan CHIP program, Children's Health Insurance Insurance Program. We operate under a combination of, I don't want to be too technical here, but the waivers are a Section 1115 waiver, which is, and then a relatively new set of waivers that came about in the first term of President Bush's administration, the Health Insurance Flexibility and Accountability waivers, which also brought the opportunity to the state where a federal match for the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, if you will, rounded out the strategies of trying to assist low-income and modest-income working families with coverage. Let me turn to page 5 and just kind of set up for Lynn that in the OHP Medicaid program, it's classically known as Title 19. Title 19 of the Social Security Act created Medicaid as a national program in the middle 60s. But there are, within that population, there are persons by federal law that are eligible to participate and receive Medicaid services, and there's a listing there, and Lynn will have more information about this in just a moment, but persons receiving cash assistance through our TANF program, those who are transitioning off of TANF from a cash perspective, children in foster care, you can see a number of children age 0 to 5 up to 133 and farther up the income level. Pregnant women up to 185, persons elderly and age blind disabled, and then persons with the presumptive eligibility, and then Lynn will also talk about the standard population. The next page kind of highlights the CHIP, but I think the closing comment I want to make about the populations generally before Lynn gets into the details is that the Oregon Health Plans, about 53% of our clients are children 18 years of age or under. About 38% are between the age of 19 and 64, and about 9% are over the age of 65. Another interesting demographic is that 57% of our clients are female, with 43% being male. And lastly, demographically, is that the race ethnicity mix for the Oregon Health Plan is, in fact, higher along various categories than the Oregon population. So this is not particularly surprising. We serve people of low income. People of color tend to be have lower income and disposable incomes in the state. But we serve a large number of children and a large number of women, both pregnant women and single parent families. And for the aged, in the ages 65 or over, about 71% of the seniors that we serve are female. So we're serving low income, aged, older people with significant health issues. That's an overview of the program. And unless there are questions, Mr. Chairman, I'm ready to cede some time to my able assistant here and let her get into talking about some of the populations and covered benefits.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Spate. Further questions? If not, Ms. Reed, please.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lim Reed. the Deputy Administrator with the Office of Medical Assistance Programs. And I am going to talk about basically the portion of the presentation document under overview, pages 7 through 11. But I'd like to draw your attention to one of the slides in your handout that has the health services slides. This is page 27.
Is this the right one?
Yes.
Okay.
And it's up on the screen right now for your reference. This chart does a very good job, a good graphic display of a very complex program in terms of the populations that we serve. The chart shows the dark gray areas. Those are represent populations that we have to serve in order to draw down federal matching dollars for our Medicaid program. And within the department, we...
Mr. Chair, I believe in one of your packets,
in the special one that we had gotten earlier.
Right.
It's not in the one that was handed out today. It's in the health services cluster of overheads where we put the
winners. It says health services, ways
and means. Means February 2005, right?
That's the one.
But she's saying page 27?
Oh, and perhaps 18. It doesn't have page
18?
Number.
Okay.
I do apologize. I won't make reference to those page numbers, but they should flow in order.
Excuse me.
I did.
Yeah, okay. We're all on the same page.
Okay.
It is 18, by the way.
Thank you. In order to draw down federal match for our Medicaid program, there are certain populations that we have to cover. And I'll just mention that... I think you saw in the overview of the department when Cindy Becker and Gary Weeks were here that $3.897 billion is federal funds that comes through the Medicaid program. So in order to draw down those dollars into Oregon, we need to meet certain minimum criteria. So the dark gray shade areas are the groups we have to cover. Pregnant women up to 133% of the poverty level. And maybe just as a reference point over on page 7 in the overview section, you can see the poverty level, monthly income levels. For someone at 133% of the poverty level, a three-person household could earn up to $1,737 per month. Another piece of information that might be helpful for context setting is that where Oregon is compared to the rest of the nation in terms of the number of Oregonians who have income below the federal poverty level. Currently, as of 2003, with the U.S. Census Community Survey, Oregon ranked 15th. Now, high ranking is not a good thing in this respect, with 13.9% of our population having income below the federal poverty level. The U.S. average was 12.7%. And some of our neighboring states, to give you a perspective around us, Washington was 30th at 11%. Idaho was 16th, just below us, at 13.8%. California was 19th at 13.4%. So we do have a greater percentage of our population than our neighboring states and the nation as a whole who are living in poverty. We cover pregnant women to the beyond the mandatory level of 133%. We go on up to 185% of the poverty level, serving that population. That expansion was a two-stage expansion when we moved above the minimum. We moved up to 170% of the poverty as a first stage. We did that when the 40-cent tobacco tax was passed and there was additional revenue available to cover a greater number of low-income Oregonians. And then we went on from 170 to 185% when the legislature restructured the Oregon Health Plan and set up a group of expansion adults with a lesser benefit package in order to cover more people. We cover children under the age of 6 up to 133% of the poverty level under Medicaid. And then under our children's health insurance program, we go on up to 185%. That expansion was also funded as a result of the tobacco tax increase in the restructuring of the Oregon Health Plan. We cover children ages 6 through 18 under our Medicaid program up to 100% of the poverty level, the minimum you have to, and then on up to 185% under the Child Health Insurance Program. Foster children in substitute care, are covered up to 49% of the poverty level, although when the income is looked at for someone in that system, it's looked at as the income of the child. So most children who enter that system are a part of our Medicaid program for their health benefits. TANF families, I know that Children, Adults, and Families was here earlier in the month, and generally their income level is around 49% of the poverty level. And people who come in through that door then qualify for our Medicaid coverage. The next bar over is labeled as aged, blind, and disabled populations. The states are required to cover up to what's called the SSI level. This is supplemental security income. It's about $580 a month. And so you have to cover the population up to that level. However, back in 1981, Oregon was the first state in the nation who developed a home and community-based waiver program. And that is still viewed as an innovative program, something the president is pushing in his proposed budget as states should continue to pursue that as an avenue for cost savings in the long-term care system. But in that change back in 1981, the income level was increased up to 300% of the SSI level for people who come in through that door, which is about 225% of the poverty level. So we will cover people who qualify for long-term care up to that higher income range for their medical coverage. The next group over is a white bar. The white bars represent expansion populations that we brought in as a result of the Oregon Health Plan demonstration. And the 100% OHP standard goes to 100% of the federal poverty level. That's adults ages 19 through 64 who don't qualify for one of the other traditional Medicaid programs. And this was one of the big innovations with the start of the Oregon Health Plan was to expand coverage to this group back in 1994. The next bar over is the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, FEOP. I believe in maybe March 3rd or so, that you'll be hearing from the Insurance Pool Governing Board. Rocky King is the administrator, and this FEOP program is administered by that board. And he'll be talking about this program. But this is a program that basically draws in the private sector, takes advantage of commercial insurance, employer-offered insurance, and for individuals who need a subsidy in order to participate in those commercial insurance products, this is a program that provides that up to 185% of the poverty level.
Excuse me, Ms. Reed, could you give us an example of that? Just how would someone's private insurance coexist within that segment?
Mr. Chair, an example of that would be in order to participate in this program and in the OHP standard program, you do have to be uninsured and have to have been uninsured for the previous 6 months before you can get in the door. But there are many people whose employers offer insurance, but because there's an employee contribution, the employee can't afford to participate. And that frequently happens with dependents, where the employer might make a substantive contribution to the employee, but not for dependent coverage. So someone can come in and get coverage for their kids. Maybe they're already covered. But through the employer now, there's a subsidy available through the FEOP program to meet the employee's portion of the cost for the KIG coverage through the employer. And that's very cost-effective. It has, in some cases, employer dollars at work, a certain amount of client dollars at work, and then state dollars as well with federal matching dollars.
Thank you. I want to be a little more specific about that for those of us who might be employers or employers who are interested. If we took that that example and said went to page 7 and looked at the federal poverty level listings there, a family of three at 185% of the poverty level at $2,416, if their employer, for instance, paid 80% for the employee and they had to make a 20% contribution, and the remaining cost to the employee to add their family was $200, what portion of that then would the FEOP program subsidize?
The FEOP program has a sliding scale for the subsidies, and it ranges from a 95% subsidy down to a 50% subsidy. At this level, you'd be at a 50% subsidy, and the FEOP program would pay $100, and the family would be responsible for $100, with the employer paying the other percent.
Okay, and how are employees made aware that that program is available?
FEOP does, Mr. Chair, FEOP does a lot of marketing, and they work particularly with insurance agents. And so this program is marketed through insurance agents. FEOP also, I believe, has done some work in terms of doing some marketing to small businesses that might want to be able to take advantage and help inform their employees. My level is my level of knowledge is fairly superficial. Rocky will give you in-depth information about that program when they're up.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I would only add that the other opportunity for a working family for under the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program is if group coverage is not available, they can also receive assistance for in the private individual market for either individual coverage or family coverage in the commercial sector. So it serves both working adults who have employer-based coverage and also those who don't.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, and then,
go first.
Senator Winters and then Senator Bates.
I'm sorry. I'm looking forward to Rocky coming before us so that we can ask some questions, particularly not only the methodology that they're using to market the program, but the bigger question, because last session when we dealt with this, and even in the interim, we did give them extra resources in order to go out and to expand their marketing abilities. And so we're kind of interested to see what those outcomes are.
Okay. Along the same lines, Mr. Chair, this has been a program that has been difficult to implement at this point, which is unfortunate because there's a real need for it, and frankly, the money is there. When we got our waiver, we had to guarantee that we would continue to put a substantial amount of general fund into it, which would be matched by federal funds, to maintain our effort. And we made a decision on the last session to try to channel that money primarily into group coverage, which has been very difficult to implement, and we need to talk to Mr. King about that. A decision has been recently made, I believe, and I want to ask Barney to reply to this, to go ahead and open this program up more to individuals, which is a little less cost effective, but it opens up the individual to buy this insurance. I think it's a simpler and a faster way to do it, so that employees can make that decision without depending on their employer to have to get involved with all the paperwork and difficulty of doing it. So I believe that program is probably opening up fairly quickly now, but I'd like to hear what Mr. Bates has to say about that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, I'll speak generally because clearly, as Lynn indicated, we do not administer the program. However, we work closely with the Insurance Pool Governing Board and Rocky King and his staff because of the federal match issues and working to make sure that the reporting to the federal government is correct and all that. You are correct. I believe that Rocky would describe it that there's a major effort, particularly for outreach into the individual market. there is a need, as you indicated. I think what we're confronting right now, and Rocky will go into greater detail, is really a timing issue. There's a certain degree of time that it takes, if you will, in the pipeline to describe this issue of when people first know about it, they make their application, they get qualified. If they don't have group coverage, then they can go to a private carrier, et cetera. And I believe that they've seen substantial increases in interest and in applications, but there was a lag earlier on relative to kind of strategic emphasis, and you'll get more detail about that.
Thank you.
Thank you. I just, of note, at 7,900 families, that doesn't have a whole lot of traction, or we'd probably have more people into it, because I would think that based on the criteria, there would be a large population out there that would qualify for some subsidy, much larger than the 7,900 of those who are participating, or families that are participating, might indicate.
You know, there was a huge, you know, media presence with Sean Lee, you know, on TV, even attempting to try to get more individuals, employers and individuals to access this, and we still have not had the movement. And the other concern, or the question that keeps coming up, is whether or not the paperwork that's required in order to go forward, whether it is so onerous that people just don't want to be bothered, particularly if you're small business owners. I mean, like, you know, your mom and pops, they have to do everything themselves. They don't have a CPA or somebody else sitting over there waiting to fill out all these forms for them. And if there is an overabundance of things that you must walk through, and that's something that I think that, again, will be a question. And that also could be a deterrent to individuals.
Particularly in the group market, I don't want to, again, go into great detail, but I have Rocky and I helped put this together in the early 90s. The group program is complex, and I think he would describe that it's much easier for a family seeking individual coverage. Those would be families that don't have group coverage available, because if they do have group coverage, they have to use the group coverage because of the leveraging effect of the employer. But he can get into the details of... But I would say that this program is really a forerunner in the nation of looking at how to help low-income working adults participate through the commercial sector, and it's been modeled in many other states who impact the same kind of difficulties that Senator Winters is referenced. So there's great opportunity, I think, over time to try to perfect how we administer this.
I guess my comment is that, you know, conceptually and from a philosophical standpoint, we've all said that this is very good, and something very good, we'd like to see it working. And you'd like to see a lot more than 7,900, you know, that are involved. And so then the question becomes, what are the barriers that are there? Why aren't we getting the results that we all thought that we would be getting? And so those are, and I'm sure that Rocky's listening to us as we speak.
You got that, Rocky?
Okay. Thank you. Please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The last bar on this graph is a small one general assistance program. There's actually an error on that one. The color on that one should be white. We don't have to have a general assistance program in order to draw down federal funds. We're able to provide Medicaid benefit package to this population because of our demonstration. It's a small group. In December, there were only 371 people participating in that program, and just wanted to point that out.
Can you bring the mic closer?
Oh, yes, I'm sorry.
I can't hear very much.
My apologies. I'd like to now turn your attention to the tab appendices. And move to Appendix C, which is about four pages or so into that tab. Page one of Appendix C shows over time our caseload for our various eligibility groups. And in particular, it goes back to the 2001-03 biennium, the current biennium, and then the projection for the next biennium. And there you'll see, I'll point you to the two groups called families and adults couples. These are what we commonly call the OHP standard population. These are our expansion adults, ages 19 through 64. The graph that has just popped up on the screen, the slide there, shows what's happened to that population over time. Back in January of 2003, we had about 100,000 adults participating in that program. Because of changes that were made coming out of the 2001 session related to benefits, co-payments, premiums, requirements for that population that were implemented in February of 2003, we started to see a decline in that population. May of 2003, we started seeing people being disqualified for failing to pay their premiums. People in this program have an obligation to pay a monthly premium ranging from $6 a month to $20 a month. But we have a high percentage of people in the program who have income down at 0% of the poverty level. So it can be a major investment for them to pay those premiums. The caseload continued to decline until about February of 2004. Then what we saw, the dynamic we saw happening there, was that the communities groups were mobilizing and coming together to do some sponsorship, to provide some premium assistance for clients who couldn't make their own premium payments. And so that stopped the decline in enrollment. And in fact, we saw it start to grow from that point forward. However, with the failure of ballot measure 30 and the disappropriation of general funds coming out of the April emergency board in 2004, there was no longer general fund available to support this program. But back in 2003, the legislature passed provider taxes, Medicaid managed care plan tax, and hospital provider tax, with the agreement of the payers of those taxes. And so we worked with those individuals in terms of dedicating their tax revenue towards providing some benefit for an OHP standard population.
Excuse me, Ms. Reed, you mentioned that communities came together to supplement those premium payments. What, be specific or give some examples of where those types of subsidies came from.
Union Gospel Mission, I believe, is a big organization where there are contributions made and then they're used for that purpose. There are some in other individual areas as well. It's a grassroots type of approach.
How would those organizations determine eligibility or prioritize who to help and who not? I mean, right. Do they use, what system would they use?
At this point, unless they know an individual and it's paid directly on behalf of the individual, we've established some rules in order not to get sideways with the federal government and allow basically charitable organizations, 501c organizations, who can make a decision. They can identify to us, in the case of Union Gospel Mission, I want to cover everyone with income below 10% of the poverty level. And here's a check. And we'll apply it to those accounts for those individuals. In some cases, it may be a county specific, where in Clackamas County they've said, we have enough money to pay for everyone at all income ranges or up to 50% of the poverty level, and we'll apply the money.
Thank you, and maybe Senator Bates could address this, because my thinking is going along the way, what would prevent a provider from just saying, it's a whole lot better if I give you the $6 a month to stay on the plan and I get paid than it is for you to come and me get not paid at all?
Mr. Chair, that was one of our concerns, and it's a federal concern as well, because there's a direct gain. They perceive it as a direct gain to the provider if that happens. So we've established rules that indicate that we won't accept a check directly from a provider, although if the money were given to an individual and the individual paid, we'd, of course, accept that. But providers are, the Hospital Association, for example, is providing money to Union Gospel Mission. Well, there are rules around that. We can take money from Union Gospel Mission, but as long as no more than 25% of their revenue comes from providers of medical services, but a fairly complex set of rules in the federal arena.
Let me explain to you in maybe a little simple, a little different terms.
Thank you.
What they're doing is washing the money very nicely. But
I got that in my head.
They're doing it a very legal way because they're not the major provider of that premium. If you're in a commercial, situation and someone comes to you that has commercial insurance, they have a 20% copay to see a hospital or be in the hospital or see a physician. That copay is there for several reasons, one of which is to help control the cost of that insurance by saying don't over-utilize that service. Okay, if the provider starts giving that 20% copay by saying we're not going to collect it or we're going to give it to you to get back to us, you're in a situation where you essentially start, it could be in a situation where you could be churning patients, bringing people through over and over and over again, faster and faster, in order to churn money out of the system and just forego any copays or premiums. And that has not happened a lot, but has happened occasionally. And that's the basic principle of premiums and copays, is that there's some responsibility for the individual in the cost of their health care, and that makes them be a little more selective about what they do. In this particular group, it's questionable whether that's a good policy because their income levels are so low that many of them don't have even minimal copays or premiums we're talking about here, and they have sometimes no way of paying that. They haven't got checking accounts. They can't get to a money order situation. They can't just send cash through the mail, and so they drop out of the program for that reason. And so it's a whole different sort of group of people you're talking about. And some of us felt that the idea of charging a premium in this group was probably, at best, ill-conceived and not really productive for what we wanted to do. Frankly, there's another problem with this group of people, which is this. We're using a first-in and first-out situation for declining this population. That means that if you're in early and you keep paying your premium, you stay in the program, well, you will ultimately end up with a situation where you have people outside the program who are at a lower income level than people inside the program. Mm-hmm. Now, all the income levels for these people are incredibly low, so maybe it's a moot point, but the inequity is that you'll have people inside and outside, not based on their income levels or poverty levels, but by who got in first and who was able to maintain that premium. And there's an inequity there. Maybe it's more scholastic than real, but it's...
Mr. Chairman, I would only add one other point to this discussion about premium assistance, and that is a good share of the premium assistance, I believe, that we're receiving through on behalf of clients through 501c3 charitable organizations is really aimed at persons who are about ready to lose their coverage for non-payment of a premium. So we, in working with other organizations, make organizations aware of either in a particular area or based upon what their desires of assistance are, how many people, let's say in a given month, it could be 2,000 people are about to lose coverage for non-payment of their $6, and many of these charitable go to help those people specifically. In fact, I believe most.
Well, thank you. I appreciate just vetting that out a little more.
Thank you.
Please continue.
Mr. Chair, the last comment I'll make on this particular slide is that because this program now is only supported with provider taxes, the premiums paid by the individuals who are participating in the program and then matching federal dollars, there isn't enough money to support the program as it existed last summer or as it currently exists. We expect that that revenue source will support about 24,000 people in the program. So since last July, the program has been closed to new enrollment, and we're watching from month to month as the program enrollment declines. We seem to be on target we believe, for hitting the 24,000 sustainable number by the end of this biennium. Currently, the most recent enrollment number, if I have it close here, February 12th, enrollment was at 31,400. That's the most recent enrollment number. So it is moving down.
Yeah. Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there a kind of rule of thumb that we, in terms of how much general fund would it take to per 1,000 of new enrollees or per 1,000 enrollees?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, I don't have that information readily available, but we can get it for you.
One clarification, Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen. Are you speaking to the standard population specifically? Okay, because it would vary based upon category, but I'm assuming that that was what you were asking for.
Yeah. Well, for example, if we could find, you know, $12 million in general fund to supplement the standard, how many enrollees
okay.
would that
well,
we can just use as a yardstick.
Knowing that time is moving along here, I'll just also mention that there are some other populations that I didn't talk about in the previous slide that you can see mentioned here on this page. There's the CAWM, Citizen Alien Waived Emergency Medical Program. This is a program we're required to have by the federal government. It's for non-citizens who don't qualify for our regular Medicaid programs by virtue of their citizenship, but they meet all the other criteria. For those individuals, we're required to provide labor and delivery and emergency medical benefits, and we do so. About 22,000 people in that program. And then we have some programs down below that are labeled non-organ health plan Medicaid. They're programs that deal with Medicare beneficiaries who have income below 100%, they're qualified Medicare beneficiaries, QMB. We're responsible for paying their Medicare premium, coinsurance, and deductible because they're low income. The other group that...
Can we just for a moment, Reps and Hannah?
Well, could you please repeat the acronym for... CAWM
is Citizen Alien Waived Emergency Medical.
Okay. And I have a follow-up to that, if I might, then. How do you differentiate between citizen alien and those folks that are qualify under standard? In other words, what kind of proof of citizenship or lack thereof? What's the measurement there between the two?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hannah, the eligibility piece of determining who's eligible actually is not handled by OMAP. It's handled by children, adults, and families, and seniors and people with disabilities in their field structure. I believe that children, adults, and families was here earlier in the process, and seniors will be here next week. So I'm going to speak a little bit just from my general knowledge base. The application specifically asks whether or not someone is a citizen, and of course, if they indicate they're not, then there is a follow-up on that. There also are... information is requested in terms of there's a whole series, I think, actually in statute, or maybe it's an administrative rule, of things that people look at to determine citizenship. But it doesn't necessarily mean that you go out to a database and you can see a U.S. citizen there. So there certainly is the possibility that someone could indicate they were a citizen and not be. But there are a number of things that are checked in the eligibility process looking to verify citizenship.
The follow-up to that, and it could be that we'll deal with children, adults, and families on this issue to a greater degree, but I know in my district I've had state policemen tell me the story of stopping a car asking for ID, seeing a DMV ID, getting deeper into the conversation and find out that the folks there with the ID are here to get medical care. And so that difference between how you get signed up and those things that are considered proof of citizenship or residency, whatever those are, seem to be critical, and that if we are serving a population that in some way is fraudulently or whatnot obtaining access to care, it would seem a shame that we're not watching that awfully close.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, I do understand the concern, and it has been an area that the department has focused on in the past, but I do have to defer to the eligibility part of our agency to respond directly. Barney, did you have?
I just wanted to add a couple of points. One, for qualified or non-qualified aliens, this is a group of people other than undocumented aliens. They probably have every reason to answer the question, are you a citizen, to answer it forthrightly and to say no. And I believe in those situations, and I would defer to my colleagues in children and adult, is that they work with INS to confirm their alien status. But I would read to you, just a, and I'll provide this in writing to staff after the hearing, but HHS federal regulation, I think this one sentence kind of summarizes the way we are managing the program, is that all immigrants, both qualified and non-qualified, as well as those who are residing in this country in an undocumented status, may be eligible for treatment of an emergency medical condition only, provided that they otherwise meet the eligibility criteria for the state's Medicaid program. That's basically, that's the best sentence I found to describe what the federal requirements are on us. You raise a different part of that issue, which would be somebody who is claiming to be a resident and is not. Mm-hmm. And again, we get more expertise from those on the front line of the tools that they have at their disposal to do that.
Knowing that we've, unless someone wants some particular information about the smaller non-OHP programs, I'll just refer you back to the text of the document where there is some discussion under the OMAP overview about each of those program areas, and then move on to briefly talk about the benefits that are available to our clients participating in the program. There is a slide here that gives a graphic display. It's also on page 10 of the overview document. And we have in what's called the OHP Plus benefit, this is where the majority of our clients, the benefits that they have, about 358,000 of clients are in this benefit. And it's a comprehensive benefit package. These are the categories of service that are covered, although these categories are overlaid with that prioritized list that Barney talked about, where the Health Services Commission has identified the most effective treatments. And so these services are covered if they're associated with a covered condition and its treatment on the prioritized list. It's a full range of care, including dental care. It also includes medical transportation to access medical services, hospital, prescription drugs, physician services, various therapies. When you move over to the OHP standard column, this is for the 31,000 now population that we're currently covered. They have a more limited benefit package. Their dental care is a limited emergency dental benefit. Hospital care is somewhat limited and does ensure coverage for emergency and urgent care and then some additional hospital care.
May I interrupt for a moment? Is there a time in the presentation where we will hear from you as far as your recommendation relating to, like, the governor's recommendation that dental be taken from the plus program and whether or not that is a wise move for us to make. I know it kind of puts you in an interesting situation, but the governor has his opinion, and you're the experts on this program and on the populations and the people, and we're here to try and pass a budget and do what's going to be best for Oregon's most needy, and so we would like to have your opinion on some of these proposed cuts.
Mr. Chair, of course, indeed, I do work for the governor and am presenting the governor's recommended budget. And in the building of that budget, though, the governor and his staff came to the departments, to the agency, and sought our input in the building of that because the resources were so significantly constrained, could not include everything that we were currently providing. And so this was in our list of one of the options available to him if he wasn't able to invest in everything, and dental dental was on that list, partially because
Wait a second. Dental was on that list is a lot different than dental is one of the proposals that get eliminated. And so I guess what I'm asking is it correct that your department recommends that out of all of the benefits that are provided in the PLUS program, that dental should be one of the first things taken out, as well as vision and those? I'm just trying to get a sense, as compared to maybe moving up as far as the, you know, the list of the 750 going up a few points or whatever it would be to whatever the numbers would work out to make the same savings. I think we're talking about, is it $12 million, I believe, is the cost of the dental portion of the package. And so I just want to know if your recommendation is that that's really something that we can just, that we should take out before we take out anything else.
Mr. Chair, we do support the governor's budget, and which includes the elimination of dental for adults. The reason why you don't see a line movement, which is the way the Oregon Health would be managed in terms of if it was necessary to reduce services, is that the federal government has to approve a line movement. The last time we went to the federal government with a line movement, they would only allow us to move 3 of 30 lines, and we don't believe that they will approve a further reduction with the list as it exists today.
Okay, well, that was then, and this is now, of course, and so I'm wondering if the real message is that the government prefer a line movement, and if that didn't work, then we ought to remove these other benefits, or if it's better not to even attempt that because we're better off just removing the benefits that have been proposed in the governor's recommended budget. Now, you know, I'm probably going beyond your ability really to answer that in this open forum.
Well, thank you. Well, we're going into the area of questions that you probably either can't answer or will be uncomfortable answering. If we're not going to be moving the line, would backfilling by bringing back the 10-cent a pack cigarette tax that was dropped with Measure 30, would that be a way that could potentially restore the dental benefit?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hansen.
Political comment more than a question. Maybe there is a...
I'm not in a position to answer that. I deal with managing the expense side of the budget, and the revenue issues are handled in other areas.
Okay.
I would like to respond to your question, Mr. Chair, is that in a phase two, we will be walking through each of the suggested areas of reductions from the current service level. And in addition, I'm assuming that when we get into the priorities and the 10% cut, you'll look at other areas that we have put on the list, so to speak. So we'll have a probably a full and rich discussion of each of these issues.
We certainly will. At the end of phase one, this committee will be making recommendations as to what the priorities ought to be, and it's already been mentioned that you know, the priorities that we've been given by DHS so far may not represent what the priorities will end up being, since we have felt that they have not reflected the key top priorities all the way down to the least important priorities. And so we're wondering whether or not DHS will provide us with a revised attempt at those prioritization. And since Assistant Director Cindy is saying that that's not going to happen, we're happy to make our own decisions on the priorities, because after all, it's called you pick. Senator Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. more of a comment, I suppose, than a question here. Dental care, especially through managed care, has been one of the or the stars of, this, of the Oregon Health Plan. We're looking at a budget that includes in it well over $1 billion in general fund money as being put up as match. We're looking at $12 million in dental, which is a scratch. I mean, $12 million to me personally would be a lot, okay? But we're not talking about me, we're talking about a huge plan here. One of our priorities should be, as we go through this, to maintain the plans we have, to maintain the structures we have in this. And by completely eliminating one piece of a plan, you lose the entire structure, which you probably cannot rebuild. That structure took 10 years to build. The health plans we have, for managed health plans we have, and the dental community stepped up and done this. If we are to eliminate it entirely, we'll probably lose them permanently. And so one of the things we have to consider in our priorities, in our own mind, is maintaining the structure of the plan. And I would tell you, from this senator's point of view, that dental is not going to be cut out of the Oregon Health Plan. We will find ways to fund that. It'll be our responsibility, and we understand that. But there is ways to maintain those plans, and we will do so. At what level will be, I'm not going to say now, but we have to maintain the structures of the plan, or we'll throw away too much of the spianium for rebuilding at a later time.
I certainly support your analysis on that, and I'm sure that our committee can come up with creative ways to come up with that $12 million. Senator Winters, did
Mr.
you have...
Mr. Chair, just piggyback on the dental issue. I always find it interesting that somehow when we look at health care needs, that somehow that's kind of tacked on. And yet that, too, is a part of the body. And it has a clearly a function that, if it's not functioning properly, ends up having problems in the body someplace else. I kind of scratch my head and saying, well, it's the same way with the eye. I mean, there's reasons why we have this anatomical body that we have, and it produces certain things that makes the rest of it go. Also, I think we've known over studies in the past that if you don't take care of dental needs, we have an extremely difficult time in getting individuals employed. So, you know, in addition to the health side of it, there is also the other piece of it that says if we're expecting individuals to get a job, and what happens, you don't go out there with the job with the mouth all full of cavities and what have you. So,
or no teeth.
Mr. Chair, could I make a comment? First, I joined the agency 98 days ago when the budget was being put together. But one of the things I just observed, even as a newcomer, is none of the choices, whether they're in the governor's recommended budget or the other choices, are choices that my staff, our colleagues, the management of DHS, enjoy making. The fact that dental was placed on the list, I mean, we had to place a number of issues out there. They're all tough, and I just want to leave you all with a message that I don't believe that reflects our lack of understanding of the role of sound dental health into physical health. These are tough choices, and we lay a menu out. The governor makes his, he proposes, and as you so eloquently said, the legislature disposes. That's what I learned in Political Science 101.
And we know it's not easy. Senator,
I think we've read into a very interesting area here. I think it's known in this budgeting process as phase two. So we should probably get back, headed on our short timeline to try to...
Okay, moving ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the last coverage item I'll mention and then cede my seat to Judy Moore Peterson to talk about performance measures and outcomes, is that we do pay for Medicare Part B premiums for about 71,000 Oregonians who are Medicare beneficiaries. They're low income, and the Medicaid program pays for those premiums in order to, for those individuals to have Medicare as a primary payer for their health care services. That's estimated to the growth rate of that premium has been pretty significant in recent years. So that's several million dollars in the budget goes towards that benefit. And with that, I will be glad to yield my seat here to Judy.
Thank you very much.
Before Judy moves into performance measures and outcomes, I'll pick up on page 12 under the tab OMAP overview, because I certainly want, before the conclusion of today's meeting, to get that back to the direction from Senator Bates. My concluding area, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, is to talk about the OMAP service delivery, or what I would call the strategies of purchasing and managing health care costs. As it's noted in the top of that page, is that we basically have three fundamental strategies of management. One, managed care organizations, and we've already referenced those, to go through and define some acronyms, and I'll try to stay away from acronyms, but the managed care organizations represent in the healthcare arena, physical health, fully capitated health plans, in the mental health arena, and you'll hear, and you've heard about this from OMHAS, is the mental health organizations, or MHOs. Dental care organizations provide the dental services, and then we have a single chemical dependency organization in Deschutes County. And then you can see at the top of page 13, those are the MCOs. About 73% of our membership clients are enrolled in we have in the physical health side, we have almost 75% in managed care, and in the mental health and dental health, it's exceeding the 80%. I'll get into a little more detail on that. The second strategy is the fee-for-service system. Classically, the state Medicaid programs have been fee-for-service-based since their initiation in the 60s. We continue to have some part of our membership in fee-for-service. Our goal, my goal, I think it's the policy goal of the legislature, is to enroll as many Medicaid members in managed care as possible. But both based on the rural and frontier nature of parts of the state, managed care does have some difficulty of surviving. We've got some strategies for that came out of last session, but we do have a fee-for-service system. And then overlaying the fee-for-service system is a primary care manager system, which is basically to try to add primary care case management in selected areas for in the fee-for-service domain. Let me spend some time now on the issue of managed care, and this is what Senator Bates, I think, alluded to earlier, and the comments that I'd like to make, because I said earlier in the presentation that I think this is a core pillar of the Oregon Health Plan, and in many ways differentiates Oregon from a number of the other states that I think Senator Winters was referencing earlier. We have contracts in the physical health side with 14 organizations throughout the state who provide services, medical services on a prepaid capitated basis. And we will get you a list of these organizations and where they're headquartered, and I've actually got better eligibility information in a table that I'll provide to you within 24 hours. But the point I want to make about managed care, and particularly with an emphasis on medical care, is, as Senator Bates indicated, these 14 organizations are in many cases, if not most cases, what I would call homegrown. They're community-based. They arose in the early 90s and continue with strong sponsorship from their local communities, from their local medical providers, primarily through organizations called Independent Practice Associations, IPAs, and many of them have strong partnerships with their local hospital providers. The number of plans that we have recognizes, in my mind, the great diversity that we have in Oregon, both from a population geographic isolation perspective, and also the variation in kind of the medical care communities. I think the continued success of managed care in the state compared to others is, in fact, that the fully capitated health plans are community-based, are tied very tightly to their local medical community and to their local hospital community, and is a real part of our ongoing success. I want to stop though and say that I approach my role as a purchaser of healthcare, not unlike perhaps a purchaser in a business, and I have basically two lines of business that I'm responsible for managing. One line is what I call the insured line of business, and that's where, through our managed care contracting processes, we transfer the risk, the financial risk, for both dental care, physical health, and mental health to these organized systems that are locally based to manage via contract an enrolled population. They're paid on a per capita basis every month, and they have certain responsibilities under the contract to organize and deliver the various services that they're paid for. In that insured line of business, my key role is to make sure that, one, the contracts and the approaches that we're using are consistent with both state law and federal law, and that they are delivering the value that I think both the taxpayer and the clients that we're responsible for require. And that value is really a function of access to timely, quality medical care, particularly primary care, but across the whole continuum of primary, specialty, and hospital care. The second line of business that I manage is what I would call a self-administered, self-insured line of business, which is the classic or traditional fee-for-service line of business. We don't have the same tools at our disposal for managing the care. We have used a number of innovative approaches, not unlike other states, in the area of disease management, and OMPRO review, et cetera. But I would admit, and I think many of you are more knowledgeable than I, is that, you know, what we would like to do is, over time, either through fully capitated health plans, the new primary care organizations, is to get as many people into the managed care construct, because it's the way I believe we get value. We get access, we get local utilization and quality management through the engagement of basically the panels of physicians and other providers that are working at that community level. Senator Bates referenced earlier, and I believe Senator Winters alluded to it, is that some of the failure of managed care on the commercial side, even in the state, but particularly nationally, was not only a disconnect of the managed care theories, many of which I think are very sound, from consumers, it was a disconnect from providers. And one of the things that I think that we have been able to sustain the fully capitated health plan, and was referenced the dental community, is the deep ongoing involvement of those providers in operating their plans locally. And without their assistance, the program that Lynn and I and others are responsible for simply would not be able to operate with the degree of efficiency and what I believe long and degree of access and degree of quality. The pages following the managed care, and I'll stop preaching there. And just,
Director, I have a question on what you're saying. What I'm hearing you say is that the private sector had HMOs in the early 90s, and then there was a transition out of that, primarily driven by the providers, into a private sector majority model, which is fee-for-service, but that the Oregon Health Plan has continued with managed care and has a history that shows that it actually is more cost-efficient, providing better services and so forth, and that this model should be expanded within the Oregon Health Plan, and presumably that if it's good for the Oregon Health Plan, it would actually be good for the private sector, and that it may be a model that needs to be revisited for private sector providing of services, medical services?
Mr. Chairman, after 28 years in healthcare, I don't have any great dreams anymore. but I would, and not to be facetious, I believe that the core of the Oregon Health Plan continues to demonstrate in a publicly sponsored program for a uniquely vulnerable population that good physician-driven managed care can deliver cost-effective care and can promote access to prevention, to early intervention, and the appropriate use of high-technology hospitals, et cetera. I think ultimately in some of these communities where that's being demonstrated on a day-to-day basis, I would hope that the private sector purchasers would learn of what good utilization management can be when you have physicians engaged in setting those standards, disciplining themselves and their peers, working together on tough problems of utilization management, how do we introduce a new technology, et cetera, et cetera. Those are challenges that are confronted daily through the fully capitated health plans and their physician partners, their hospital partners, and other providers. I think the absolute magic of the Oregon Health Plan from a managed care point of view is that. And I was involved in the private sector, and I have to say my own personal opinion, the absolute negative management magic of the failure of managed care, and I would look to Dr. Bates, is in fact that many commercial companies did not create that linkage with primary care and with medicine. It was a co-managed game of trying to get as high a value, appropriate access, medically appropriate care for the best dollar available. I hope personally that there's some return to it in a new model. I think evidence-based medicine, which I've talked about, I think the whole issue of prioritization, I think we've got a whole lot more skills today than we had 20 years ago or even 10 years ago. So I continue to believe it's a model for Medicaid, but I would be, I guess, so naive and hopeful as that I think it continues to be a model for other populations.
Senator Bates and I have discussed the coming storm. I mean, as you look at the ever-increasing double-digit annual incline on expenses for just health care in general, the effects it's having on groups and the number of employers that are getting out of providing benefits because of the rising costs, yet the increasing need for the population, all of us, to have reasonable and affordable health care, that the legislature eventually will need to take on this as vital a committee as PERS was 2 years ago, because we were faced with a $17 billion crisis there, and it required dealing with it, and it was a very difficult decision, and we don't know what the outcome is going to be, but the focus was obvious. And in the legislature, and it probably is not going to happen this session, but maybe next session, we believe that there should be that kind of a focus on the health care crisis for providing resources, and not resources, but coverage to Oregonians, private, public. And so I believe that this whole dialogue and discussion will come up again, and hopefully we'll be able to have a model that will be valuable to both sectors. Anyway,
I hope so too, Mr. Chair, and I think there are a number of people that are in this room or maybe watching, or you've already met from the managed care community in the state that are going to be key allies and probably contributors to that further dialogue.
I'm not sure what the result will be, but I know that we need the dialogue. Senator Winters.
Mr. Chair, since you've raised the subject, as you know, I had the summit in December 15th of this year for the very purpose of to begin to highlight what you just described, and even beyond that, we do have a medical crisis, and we've got it now. It didn't just happen today, but as I hear Barney and others talking, and we talk about rising costs, and we talk about access, and access is even an issue with if you have insurance in the state. I'm mindful of even in managed care, if you don't have adequate physicians in the state of the number in Oregon, and you don't have the other allied health systems that are available here, we still haven't fixed the problem.
That's right.
So it is one that I think, and as you probably can guess, you've got 1, 2, 3, 4 entities from the Senate side, all of whom are very, very much as a part of their passion to work to fix the health care problem from a system standpoint in Oregon. And it is for all Oregonians, because the need and the problems are there. So I just had to put, since you opened that door. I just had to say that. And the summit will be, we'll have another summit. We're not going to wait until this legislative body decides there's enough interest in of individuals and entities and groups to want to begin planning and to go forward.
Mr. Chairman, I would only the last point I'd like to make in this, it's been I really appreciate the dialogue from the point of view of looking forward, is that if all politics is local, all healthcare is local, and the cost issue, the access issue, the quality issue is generally a local healthcare phenomena. The solutions lie locally. Some of the models may come from elsewhere, but the solutions are generally local, and they involve the leadership of medicine, the leadership of hospitals, the leadership of the other care deliveries. And I think what we've got going for us in that potential debate is, in fact, we've got communities, because this population is vulnerable, because it is viewed from a kind of a social services point of view, is if we don't take care of them now, it'll be more expensive to take care of them later. Some of these tools have been tried in some of the most difficult populations and are working. And that's why I think they hold some promise for the future in other populations.
Thank you. Senator Bates.
And I'll make a very short comment because we could spend weeks and months on this topic and be here forever and not reach a resolution. But I think the last comments made by Barney are really the key ones here. Government has a role to play in this. What is happening in health care is not going to be supportable in the long run. It just is not going to be supportable. What's driving it is multifactorial. It's aging populations, high tech in hospitals. It's the American public not being willing to quit smoking and not deal with obesity. It is our health care system not delivering in an efficient manner. However, one of the bright spots in this is our local managed care plans. We are actually seeing those managed care plans now thinking about and starting to move into other areas other than Medicaid. Mm-hmm. Medicaid really, what Barney runs, the biggest insurance agency in the state of Oregon, and that's true of every state. But we're seeing these plans now starting to branch out and thinking about taking on Medicare populations. I know of one that is talking amongst itself of taking on its own population. They have 400 or 500 physicians in the IPA. And they think they can insure themselves and take care of their employees in a better and more cost-effective manner than going to commercial insurance. So when we start seeing those movements, we know that they've developed tools locally that are holding health care costs down and can drive it forward. Also in this discussion is that Oregon and most of the western states are delivering health care more efficiently than the rest of the nation as a whole, significantly. And so we're already, to a certain point, one of the most efficient systems available, yet we still have a long ways to go.
And we get penalized.
And we get penalized. No good deed goes being punished, and we are punished by the federal government for our efficiency. But the point I'm trying to make is that I think the most important part we should take away from this discussion is that local solutions will bring us out of this. I don't believe the top-down will do it. And, Barney, I think you're absolutely right.
Mr. Chair, in a wrap-up, first of all, thank you for those kind words. Senator Bates, I'd like to take you back, and I don't run the largest insurance company. I'm a very significant large public purchaser of care. I want to continue to cast this responsibility as a purchaser because I purchase insured services, risk transferring services through these other organizations. I would just point out in Appendix E we have some maps that are probably very difficult to read. The tables that I'll make available to you by tomorrow will give county-specific enrollment information on managed care in both physical, dental, and mental health. So that's Appendix E. We did put in, because we deal in health care, we deal with all sorts of terms and acronyms, Appendix F. I hope we've avoided as many of the acronyms, but there is some definition there for to help you if you want to review any of that. I'm at a point of closing on the overview and moving to performance measures, and I look, Mr. Chair, to you. Would you like us, since the 2 minutes to the hour, to come back and be able to do that very in the first thing tomorrow morning?
I think it'd be wise for us to delay so that we could have uninterrupted dialogue.
Okay. We will do that, and we look forward to doing it, and thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much. We're adjourned.